This is the Untold Civil War Podcast, and I'm your host, Paul, and on this episode, we're going to be discussing one of the leading politicians during the war, Senator Henry Wilson. He was the chairman of the Committee on Military Affairs and would eventually become Grant's vice president. But before we do that, I just want to thank my patrons on Patreon, whose assistance keeps this show thriving. My patrons are all in the running for our Remembrance Day raffle. Drawing will be done in Gettysburg in November during the Remembrance Day festivities. Winner will receive a signed copy of A Rebellious Woman by Claire Griffin. This is a historical fiction novel about Belle Boyd's exploits of espionage. The winner will also receive a Confederate War Bond token. So sign up and become a patron. Link in the show notes. And now, pour yourself a double scotch on the rocks, light that cigar, and let's delve into some Untold Civil War. Welcome to the Untold Civil War podcast. I'm with Lincoln Annibale, host of the Henry Wilson and the Civil War podcast. It is a relatively new podcast with a fascinating topic, and it's a real pleasure to have you on the Untold Civil War. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
So just to kick this off, I always like to ask, you know, when did the Civil War bug bite you? You know, when did you, and also when did you start to decide to podcast and get into this whole world that we're in?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, when I took my high school history class, I was just fascinated by the Civil War and just learning about all of the different characters involved and just the storyline of the Civil War is just incredible. And then right at the start of 2020, I learned about Henry Wilson, who is, of course, the subject of my podcast. I'd always known who he was because we both share kind of a hometown. I had attended Henry Wilson Middle School and lived in the Henry Wilson Historic District, you know, lived literally on the same street that his house was on. And yet I really didn't know about Henry Wilson at all, besides he was the 18th vice president. You know, I started doing just some light research, you know, reading the Wikipedia page. And then, you know, I started reading the biographies of him. Just learning about the Civil War even further just totally made me so excited to continue into this research and just learn more about the Civil War. And there was also an element where I was just surprised that in my history classes, I had never learned about Henry Wilson, who was this great hero of the Civil War. And yet, you know, from my hometown, you know, I went to the school named after him, and yet I had never actually learned about him. So I was just led on this journey of learning about both Henry Wilson and, of course, the Civil War.
What I like about, you know, that story is that I often talk about Untold Civil War, how we talk about these stories that no one really hears about or it hasn't been talked about much. And yet they're not hidden stories. I mean, these are stories that are right in front of you. Like you said, you know, your school's named after this gentleman. You might even walk past a monument to this guy or something like that. And yet no one pays it any mind. It's like hidden right in front of you, right? But exactly, it's so great that you're finally shedding some light on this character because Henry Wilson is fascinating. Let's dig into the meat and potatoes of this. Henry Wilson, how did he get his start in life?
Yes. So Henry Wilson just lived an absolutely fascinating life. Every single aspect of his life has a story behind it, and that's absolutely fascinating. He was actually born not in Massachusetts, but in New Hampshire, in Farmington, New Hampshire. He was born to Abigail and Winthrop Colbath, and they were extremely impoverished. They had been in families that were generationally poor. His father was an alcoholic and could never hold down a job. So his family really struggled to make ends meet. And when Henry Wilson was born, he was actually given the name Jeremiah Jones Colbath. His parents did this because there was a wealthy landowner who lived down the road named Jeremiah Jones. And they reasoned that if they named their son after him, he might add them to his will. Really from his start, that kind of the symbol of desperation kind of clouded Henry Wilson's life, even with his naming Jeremiah Jones Colbath. His parents indentured him as an indentured servant to another farmer who lived down the road. And Wilson worked on that farm for about 10 years. He was indentured for 5 of those years. And when that indentured servitude ended, he was paid $84, which is incredibly small sum, even at that time for 5 years of work. But he was just incredibly happy to have this money. And throughout his entire childhood, he lived a very sad childhood. He had no friends. He very rarely could afford to go to school. but he always had a fascination with books, and he loved reading, and he acquired access to a private library in Farmington where he could read, and he read thousands of books in his childhood. So once he got that money from his indentured servitude, he heard that there were some jobs in Massachusetts that had been popping up in the shoe industry. So he walked 100 miles by foot to Natick, Massachusetts. He did this in about 2 days. And of course, Natick is also my hometown. So that's where I learned about Henry Wilson. And he came to Natick and he started a shoe business, became a shoemaker. And the shoes that he made were called brogans. And they're this type of leather shoe that were sold primarily to Southern plantations for enslaved people's feet. And they were very cheap. But, you know, it starts with this kind of great contradiction of Henry Wilson, who would go on to become the nation's leading political abolitionist, making shoes for enslaved people's feet. And I think that's a great example of how just entrenched this system of slavery was throughout the entire country. And there are actually on his business record times when he rejected payment because he found out that the debts that were being owed were coming from the sale of men. So he rejected that. So he was always very principled in that aspect. Before he became enlightened to the anti-slavery cause, he became ill and the doctor ordered him to go to the South. He took a trip to Washington, D.C., which really isn't as far south as you're supposed to go at that time to heal your sickness. But he went to the South and that was really the first time that he saw slavery in action. And on his train ride, he remarked, "This is just a terrible thing." And the person sitting next to him said, "Be quiet. You could get arrested for saying that in the state of Maryland. So like, watch out." And from that point on, he dedicated his life to ending slavery. And many years later, he would become the person to emancipate the slaves of Washington, D.C. So a great circle of events that resulted in that. But once he got back to Natick, he was inspired, of course, and he jumped right into Massachusetts politics. He won a seat in the Massachusetts House. He was a Whig at the time, and party politics play a huge role in Wilson's life. You know, as we'll see, he joined the Whig Party. William Lloyd Garrison around this time said that Wilson's speeches were, you know, some of the most forceful anti-slavery speeches in any state legislature in the country. So Wilson really started his career being anti-slavery, and he led the charge for the, you know, conscience divide between the Whig Party. There was a cotton versus conscious kind of sex of the Whig Party. And he led that group to leave and form the Free Soilers. And he became a national leader in the Free Soilers. And then he became a Know-Nothing, which was an anti-immigrant party, actually, that really took hold in Massachusetts in the early 1850s. But he always rejected any notion of being anti-immigrant. But somehow he actually talked his way into obtaining the Senate seat through the Know-Nothing Party in the United States Senate. And all just throughout his time in the early Massachusetts politics is just fascinating stories of him working with his colleagues and really honing in on his political skills and his debate craft. And once he was in the Senate, he was lifelong friends with Charles Sumner, who of course is famous for the Brooks-Sumner incident. And that was really when Wilson was kind of shot to power because he rejected a duel from Preston Brooks, who was the person who assailed Charles Sumner. And that really, really made him a hero in the North and kind of an enemy in the South. And that's kind of the road to the Civil War. He was just a leader in the Senate at that time. But he always got along with his Southern colleagues, especially Jefferson Davis. Or along this whole time, he was also a member of the Massachusetts militia. He had become a general in the Massachusetts militia. So he was always given that nickname along with the Natick Shoemaker. He was branded the General Wilson. So those are all leading to the Civil War. That was kind of his life up to that point in politics.
Remembrance Day at Gettysburg is coming up. I hope you'll be appropriately kitted out. If you're missing anything, check out our sponsor, the Badge Maker. He has for sale some GAR medals and pins that will be perfect for the occasion. Use the link in the show notes and be the envy of all your reenacting friends.
I mean, during that time, it's, you know, we talk about interesting political times today, but especially during that time as well. I mean, you know, beating someone over with a cane right there. Very interesting.
Right.
you also mentioned that he was ill for a little bit. Was this an illness that plagued him throughout his career or?
No. So the illness that he had in the, you know, late 1830s, it was actually likely a lung hemorrhage that had been caused by him breathing in the leather from the shoes. at least that's my theory of it. He was an incredibly hard worker. He once tried to make 100 shoes in a day. He stayed up all night for 24 hours just hammering out these shoes. He wasn't successful. He only got to about 50, but he was just always an incredibly hard worker and always pushed himself to the edge. And when he got sick, why he was working so hard at that time was to try and afford an education, because he had never actually been formally educated. He'd only attended school for about a month if you added up all of the kind of random days, and he was working to get that money to send himself to school to become educated. So, but it was never an illness that plagued him for the rest of his life. His wife, on the other hand, was sick his entire life.
You know, we've set the stage here, and of course, this is the Untold Civil War podcast. We like to talk about the Civil War. So where exactly was he when Sumter is fallen and this war kicks off? Where exactly is he and what role is he playing?
Yeah, so of course we have to go back a second to the election of 1860. And he was, you know, a huge campaigner for Abraham Lincoln. He loved to campaign, especially in presidential elections. He was at first a little bit hesitant to support Lincoln because he was more of a moderate, while Wilson was more of a radical, but he ended up supporting Lincoln. And he was happy when Lincoln got elected. You know, he could see that the South was overreacting in his view, but he felt that this overreaction of Southern secession could end up being a great, you know, violence could break out. And he pressed on Lincoln to raise troops once he took power. And he first called Lincoln to raise 300,000 troops. And everyone kind of laughed at Wilson for this, saying, why would you ever call for this much? It's not going to be that violent. But Wilson, of course, would be proven right. And Lincoln would eventually call for that same number, 300,000 troops, when the war does break out. But when the South is leaving, you know, Wilson, of course, is in the Senate. And I mentioned he was friends with Jefferson Davis, who, of course, would go on to be the president of the Confederacy. But when Jefferson Davis left the Senate, Jefferson Davis was the chair of the Military Affairs Committee, and Wilson sat on that committee. And when Jefferson Davis left, gave his farewell remarks in the Senate before literally walking out the doors to become the president of the Confederacy, he first made a stop at Wilson's desk and shook Wilson's hand and said, essentially, you know, I'm sorry I'm doing this, but it's kind of a cause greater than the both of us. And he said, quote, I hope we can meet again in calmer times. And so that was kind of the relationship that he had with his colleagues. Even though Jefferson Davis and Wilson bitterly opposed each other, when they were in the Senate, they were friends outside. And once the war does erupt, of course, Wilson takes over that role of the chair of the Military Affairs Committee and really becomes a leader of, you know, the military in Congress at that time. When Bull Run occurs, Wilson was one of the many people to follow after the Union troops. Of course, in that famous story where all of the socialites are watching the battle and they realize, you know, we have to get out of here. Wilson's buggy that Wilson had rode in allegedly was shot by a cannon or somehow destroyed. And so he had to flee by foot. And Southerners kind of charged Wilson with being a coward and used this as an example of Northern cowardice. And Lincoln also took kind of comedic value to the story and always laughed that, oh, Henry Wilson, imagine him running from the scene of Bull Run. That's really where Wilson started it off, right when the Civil War broke out.
Need help planning your next family excursion? Look no further than Civil War Trails. Their resources will help you navigate the places where Union and Confederate soldiers clashed. I personally used their help when exploring Slaughter Pen Farm. Their signs helped to interpret the battle and did share several previously unknown stories of courage to me. Learn more using the link in the show notes. And I know he had you mentioned the nickname, the General, right? How much of his militia experience assisted him during this time? Just because I know once the Civil War kicked off, there were a lot of amateurs trying to, you know, run the army, you know, run the military. There was a lot going on, more troops than had ever been assembled on, United States soil has finally being assembled. You know, did that experience actually help him in his role during the Civil War?
Well, Lincoln certainly sought his advice in the early days of the war. He actually appointed Wilson to serve on General McClellan's staff. Wilson never really liked McClellan because he was more of a Democrat. Wilson ended up leaving about 2 days after he was appointed because of just he was asked by McClellan to inspect, you know, 1,000 lines of men. And he was there for hours and hours, and he just hated that, you know, grueling work on the ground, he much preferred the legislative side of the war. And as the chair of the Military Affairs Committee, you know, this is at a time when Congress is much more in power when it comes to war than the president was at this time. So really anything that needed to get through to the army needed to go through Congress. Whenever Lincoln wanted to kind of make a power grab, that had to go through Congress. So really every single piece of legislation that came through Congress relating to the military passed through Wilson's hands. And he drafted much of that legislation. In 1862, he is the person who wrote the Conscription Act that created the national draft, of course, sparked riots across the North, especially in New York City and Boston, where just chaos occurred. And as chairman of the Military Affairs Committee, he also had to supply soldiers with clothing and with food and with everything that they needed had to be legislated somehow. So Wilson just worked painstakingly to do all of this. And he was very caught up in the details of all of this. And he really enjoyed that. And he would go and inspect the soldiers after battles to see what they needed. He was the first civilian at following the Battle of Fredericksburg. And he also was at the attended the Battle of Gettysburg after the fact. And he surveyed the men and asked, what do you all need right now? When he came back a couple of days later with all of the stuff that they had asked for, the soldiers were really shocked at this. And some had noted this in their diary that Henry Wilson was there kind of supporting them, not just in a military role, but as a person. Wilson never smoked, but he supported supplying soldiers with tobacco for their enjoyment. And so Wilson, having worked in the state militia, knew what the soldiers needed, because he had worked hands-on for so long that when he acquired this legislative role, he knew what had to be supplied and how it could be supplied strategically to enhance the war. But he certainly was held a tight budget as well. He had to watch how much money the Union was spending. Of course, Congress has that ability, you know, the power of the purse. And so Wilson watched over that quickly, and he wanted to strategically use their supplies rather than just waste everything, as the South was doing, just depleting their resources. Wilson wanted to strategically use their funds and use their supplies to help soldiers the best way that he could. And he had that experience to do so.
I just finished watching the documentary In Their Words. It chronicles the lives of several members of the 12th New Hampshire Infantry using firsthand accounts. Awesome video content like this can be found on the streaming service History Fix. Use the link in the show notes and subscribe now.
That's absolutely fascinating. Do we have any other like comments made by other generals or any other people that he worked with during this time that comment to his success?
Yeah, General Winfield Scott, of course, the famous American general who had served in just about every single war up to the Civil War, had said that Wilson had worked harder than General Scott had in all of his years of service at this time, which I think really speaks to just how not only hardworking Wilson was at this time, but how passionate Wilson was about this cause and how much he wanted to serve the Union and make sure that the Union was being supported. But, you know, Wilson was working hard as military chair, but he was also working incredibly hard for emancipation efforts as well, which is kind of that second part of his career. At the same time, he was, you know, he worked very closely with Secretary of War Stanton. So he was very often in the White House. And that's why we don't have a lot of paper records today, like letters to Wilson, to Stanton, because he was with him personally most of the time. So a lot of that record is gone. And of course, they were trying to keep a lot of their correspondence secret to avoid spies. Wilson, whenever he got the chance to see Lincoln, which was often, he was very forceful about emancipating the enslaved people and pushing for an Emancipation Proclamation. And Wilson actually wrote the D.C. Emancipation Act in 1862, which Lincoln used as somewhat of a template to make the Emancipation Proclamation just a couple months later. And the D.C. Emancipation Act freed the slaves of Washington, D.C. Wilson compromised on that bill by paying slaveholders, compensated them for the enslaved people's freedom. He morally opposed this, but he knew that the only way it would get passed in Congress would be through adding that stipulation. So while Wilson was a radical and he always pushed for equal rights, it's really incredible. It's tough to find a record where he isn't in support of completely equality for all men of all colors of, you know, every creed. And at this time, that's very unheard of. And while that was polarizing to some, his ability to compromise and still be friends with his colleagues and actually get stuff done is really key to Wilson's success. Around this time, Wilson also supported ending segregation. You know, during the war, he knew that it wasn't the right time to put forward any bills, but any time that something was up for a vote, he voted for it. During the war, most of those things failed. But he was always pushing very hard for equal rights and for civil rights and for emancipation, so much so that he annoyed Lincoln. Lincoln once commented upon seeing Wilson and Sumner and Stevens walk towards the White House. He said, "Here come those three damn fellers again," because he knew that they were there to bug him and say, you know, why aren't you doing more for the Black people in the South who are totally disenfranchised and held without rights?
I just celebrated my birthday, and I was surprised by my coworkers. It was great to have them over, and they truly enjoyed the fact that I shared with them several Civil War relics I have collected over the years. These relics mostly came from the Excelsior Brigade. They deal in some of the finest original Civil War items that you simply cannot find elsewhere. Check them out at the link in the show notes. Do we know if he played any role in the recruiting of USCTs, the colored troops?
Yeah, absolutely. If it wasn't for Henry Wilson, there likely wouldn't have been Black soldiers in the army. He was incredibly forceful on Lincoln all throughout, even the early days of the war, that the Union needed to use Black soldiers, not only because they would be a great resource in fighting, but because Wilson believed after the war, whites would see that Black soldiers had fought, and he believed that would, you know, help them get rights following the war. More political rights, especially. Once Wilson was successful in pushing Lincoln to use Black soldiers, he realized that they were being treated unfairly. White soldiers were paid, I believe, $13, while Black soldiers were paid, I think, $10, with $3 subtracted for their uniforms. Wilson saw this and was just appalled. And so he introduced legislation to try and fix that inequality. And he worked every chance he could to get better conditions for Black soldiers once he was successful in getting them in use. And his son, Henry Hamilton, who was just 17, actually joined the military and became a lieutenant of a colored regiment. So, and Wilson also founded the Massachusetts 22nd Regiment, which was before Black soldiers were used, but also a very impactful regiment in the war, that a regiment that actually fought in Gettysburg and was reported to lose about half of their men there.
Now, he didn't actually lead those troops, right? But it was sort of, he organized them, right?
Correct. Yeah. He when they were first founded, he led them from Boston all the way to DC. And then he departed from them at that point.
Well, there's no doubt that probably his organization, his ethics on that regiment, influence on that regiment probably led them to their successes. You know, there's no doubt about that. Really interesting stuff. One thing I'd like to talk about is, as we get towards the end of the war, how was that for him? I mean, how was the experience of the war? How did that shape him afterwards?
He knew that having all this military experience legislatively, he realized after the war that there were a lot of, you know, gaps in how we could unify the nation's army, because at the time, of course, it was mostly just state militias. So he worked very closely with General Grant following the war to really reorganize the army and the military generally. But just a couple things before we move to after the war that I didn't mention was, at the start of the war, he was actually rumored to have an affair with Rose O'Neill Greenhow, who was a Confederate spy. That, of course, is one of where Wilson is most commonly cited, I've found, is him alleging he had an affair. And through the research of the podcast, I kind of uncovered that that's probably not true. The letters don't seem to fit Wilson. And he just wasn't that dumb to just have an affair with a Confederate spy. He definitely certainly was friends with Greenhow and certainly may have leaked some Union secrets, especially about Bull Run. But whether those secrets had any impact on the outcome is unclear. But it's certain that he likely really didn't have an affair with Rose O'Neill Greenhow. And also during the war, along with all of this military and civil rights legislation, he also founded the National Academy of Science, which is still in use today. And it's just an absolutely fascinating story of how he became to pass this legislation and get this funded when he himself had never been formally educated, and yet he created this organization that is really fundamental to American scientific knowledge even today. But, you know, after the wars end, and he continued to work, like I mentioned, with General Grant on kind of reshaping the army and rethinking what the military could do. But he really shifted his focus to civil rights and focusing on racial equality. He was central in the passage of the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. He drafted much of the language of the 14th Amendment. And on the 15th Amendment, he wanted to add language that would have said that education could not be used as a means to disenfranchise voters, which of course, it had that had gotten through, which it didn't, it got struck. That would have stopped a lot of that Jim Crow era disenfranchisement at the polls over their education. Wilson at this time also, around the time of the 15th Amendment's passage in Congress, began to support women's suffrage and began to actually speak out about that. He was very close with Clara Barton throughout the war. And she, of course, would go on to found the American Red Cross. But she really turned the tides in his mind about women's suffrage. And he absolutely supported equality for all people. During the Reconstruction era, there's also record of him speaking out against the use of, you know, underpaid Chinese laborers to build the railroad. He spoke in favor of protecting Native American tribes and trying to preserve their culture as they saw fit. So all of these things are way ahead of his time. Of course, women didn't get the right to vote till 50 years after his death almost. So Wilson really saw the future and was real progressive in his views, especially when it came to racial equality. And Wilson led the joint committee that was tasked with trying to suppress the KKK's terrorism in the South. And he was a major supporter of the Force Acts that put heavy restrictions on those who tried to suppress Black voters and tried to disenfranchise Black voters from their 14th and 15th Amendment rights. And he introduced and supported bills that would have ended segregation across the nation. And he supported the funding of public schools. And, you know, I had mentioned Jefferson Davis's friendship with Wilson early on. After the war, Wilson was really the only Republican to support Jefferson Davis being released from prison. He visited Davis very often when he was imprisoned, wrote letters to him, maintained a friendship with him, and was really central in getting Davis released from prison, being that Republican voice in the Republican-controlled Congress, getting that happen, despite being such a radical when it came to racial equality, and he believed in politically punishing these Southern states. He was supportive of the Wade Davis bill, but he personally believed that in 100% amnesty for those who were involved in the Confederacy, and he wanted to pardon the rebels, including people like Jefferson Davis. He thought that that was the best thing to do to heal the country, and to, you know, he had his plans for bringing about racial progress in the South, and he thought that, you know, they had to unify the country as well. So it's really great contradictions in who Henry Wilson was and what he believed, but that was really all of his work added up, created just a great story during the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Love the Untold Civil War? Want more content like ours? Then check out our sponsor, Military Images Magazine, one of the best resources on Civil War portrait photography. In its pages, you'll find the stories of those soldiers who posed for their photos, the photographers who took the image, and how to spot fake/reproduction images that are plaguing the collector's market, and so much more. Link in the show notes. It seems to me, you know, people use this saying all the time, you know, he's a person ahead of his time.
Right.
Ahead of his time. I think this is very appropriate to say here. It's interesting. He seems to be a real diplomat, actually, you know, to not only push forward this great legislation, but he understands that we have to live with these people again. And so we have to unify the country. You know, that's two major issues here that he wants to see succeed. But I'd also like to get into, you talked about his relationship with Jeff Davis. What about his relationship with Ulysses S. Grant, who, you know, wins the war? And I know they would partner up pretty soon. So what about his relationship with Grant?
So during the war, of course, he first met Grant in 1864, when Grant took charge, of course, and didn't have a lot of correspondence with him. Then following the war, they worked closely one-on-one, like I had mentioned, reshaping the army. And then during the years of Reconstruction, He continued to work with Grant through the impeachment trial of Johnson, which, of course, you know, involved the removal of the Secretary of War and the appointment of Grant. And once Grant kind of rejected Johnson more forcefully, Wilson began to, you know, he was always friendly with Grant, and he took a shot at the VP slot in 1868. And most Republicans thought that it would be a Grant-Wilson ticket. Everyone knew that Grant would get the nomination. And most people suspected that Wilson would be that vice presidential nominee. On the first ballot at the convention, he ended up in third place. And then Colfax ended up winning, and Wilson ended up in fourth place by the last ballot. But around this time, his wife had become sick. Wilson's wife had become sick. So he didn't really have a lot of time to focus. But he did request that he be appointed as the Secretary of War for Grant. And Grant didn't respond to the letter at all. They saw each other not long after this at a social event, and it was kind of awkward between them. And I think that Wilson always kind of had, he was never a person to hold a grudge, but it seems their relationship was kind of tainted by this event. I get the impression that Grant really was never fond of Wilson. Others were surprised that he didn't get any cabinet position. But like I mentioned, he had to tend to his wife. So it's possible that possibly Grant gave him another slot that wasn't Secretary of War, Wilson rejected it because of his wife being ill. I also mentioned his son, who had served. His son died at just 20 years old in 1869 after getting diphtheria. He was stationed at what's now Fort Griffin in Austin, Texas. Henry Hamilton was his name, and he passed away. And he must have been a great soldier because they actually named the fort after him, the Wilson Fort, and then they changed it to Fort Griffin. Not long after, but that was also a big thing that happened in his life. So in the Grant administration, during the Grant administration, he was lonely. He, of course, still worked a lot with, you know, through the Reconstruction Acts and trying to bring about racial equality, but he was really all alone family-wise. But that, of course, changed when he won the 1872 vice presidential nomination. The Republicans narrowly rejected Schuyler Colfax, who had kind of started trouble with Grant. And Grant and Wilson ran on a ticket in 1872 of honesty and integrity, and that they were both for the laborer, that they were both working men. There's a great poster that has Grant standing up on one side, and over him it says the Galena Tanner, and then Wilson, the Natick Shoemaker. And that, I think, really encapsulates their campaign. And Wilson worked incredibly hard on this campaign. William Lloyd Garrison later noted that Wilson probably campaigned to more people throughout his life than any other American had ever at that point, speaking to probably more than a million people, which was just unheard of in a politician's life at that point. But Wilson worked so hard in the election of 1872, and of course was successful and became the vice president with President Grant.
And I'd love to ask your opinion on this, because oftentimes when you pick up a book on presidents, I mean, I know when I was a kid, I would pick up a book on presidents and I would go through it. And, you know, usually each presidency had one liner, right? And, you know, when you get to Grant's presidency, it just says, you know, something like corrupt or, you know, failed presidency or something like that. I've been studying Wilson. What do you think about that, at least the last 4 years there?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, the Credit Mobilier scandal broke the night of the election, and Wilson was implicated in some of the allegations. Wilson was just shocked by this. You know, it turned out that he was vindicated, that he didn't have any part in knowingly corruption. His wife had purchased a bond for the railroad, a very small sum of money. It's funny because Wilson never actually got wealthy. He remained impoverished his entire life. And if not impoverished, you know, middle to low class. So he really never had the money to invest in anything that would bring about corruption. So he was cleared of that, but it did kind of muddy his legacy, even just the allegations of it. And there are times during his vice presidency when he wrote to Grant and said, gave him advice on how to handle the corruption charges to kind of push the blame off. Because in the end, it seems like Grant really wasn't corrupt. It was just the people around him. And Wilson gave him a lot of advice that Grant just rejected for some reason, which kind of feeds into my notion that I had mentioned before, that Grant really didn't like Wilson for some reason. But, you know, regarding the corruption, I think that it's definitely a blot on the radical Republican legacy. But, you know, in the end, that was kind of I think, a good transition into the Gilded Age.
With that note, I would like to ask, this guy is absolutely fascinating. And why is it that he seems to fall into the realm of untold civil war? What happened there?
Yeah, you know, I should mention Wilson actually dies during his term as vice president. And the nation is just shocked by this. They're incredibly upset because Wilson was viewed as a hero to the likes of, you know, Lincoln, Grant, and Wilson. These were the three leaders of the war. Lincoln, of course, being the executive, Grant in the military, and Wilson in Congress. And it's true. These were the three true leaders, and they were viewed as such at the time. And of course, Wilson was adored for his civil rights legislation. I should say he was also hated by some circles for that, but he was always very practical, as I continue to mention. Wilson died in the Capitol building in 1875. At the time, the Capitol had baths in it for congressmen who didn't live in Washington or who didn't have homes. Wilson couldn't afford a home, so he was in the Capitol and he took a bath. He had had a stroke a couple years earlier, probably because he had worked so hard campaigning in the election of 1872. And he fell asleep in the bathtub and likely probably had another stroke. And he, a couple days later, he died in the office of the vice president in the Capitol building. And that office today is dedicated to Wilson. The official vice presidential office is dedicated to him. But for a long time, Wilson was not, you know, forgotten. He was not a part of that untold Civil War category. I found newspaper articles that reference Wilson as the person every school child knows the story of Henry Wilson and stuff like that. What I've found in how I've consulted with a Wilson biographer, John L. Myers, who is now in his 80s, but and has actually lost much of his research. But through our discussions, I believe that around this time, the people who wrote the history books were part of the aristocracy. They were from Harvard and they were from Yale. And, you know, Wilson was always looked down upon for being poor his whole life and for never receiving an education, but being so successful, it kind of, you know, bucked the narrative for these aristocratic men. You know, even Charles Sumner, his great friend for most of his life, always looked down upon Wilson, even though Sumner really needed to owe Wilson for Sumner's Senate seat. If it wasn't for Wilson, he probably wouldn't have been elected. But he was always looked down upon. And when the time came to write the history, you know, these aristocrats didn't focus on Wilson as much as they should have, just because he was not from, you know, the class that they were from. There's a lot more work done around this time on Charles Sumner, who was, you know, a hero in his own right. But Wilson was deserving of that same praise that he just didn't receive because he wasn't a part of that aristocracy. So, you know, through generations, that history gets passed down, and if it's without Henry Wilson, then he becomes forgotten. And I think that's kind of the core reason why he is mostly forgotten today.
Well, it's great what you're doing to shed more light and bring him back to the light, so to speak. Is there any reading that you would recommend, any books that you would recommend? Because I know I like to promote reading on my show. So are there any books you recommend for people if they want to learn more?
Well, you know, it's difficult to find any biographies of Wilson because they're all out of print now. But you can try and find them and buy them online. One of my favorites is Ernest McKay's Practical Radical, A Portrait of a Politician. It's you know, a good sized book. It's about 300 pages. So it's not too heavy. And then there's another shorter biography, Cobbler in Congress by John Abbott. And then there's a three-volume series by John L. Myers, the biographer I spoke to. And that is very dense. It's probably in total more than 1,000 pages. But it really goes into the meat of Henry Wilson's life and the very specific details that took over 40 years to write and research. But Ernest McKay's Practical Radical is really what I would suggest reading. And I am planning on kind of compiling my episode scripts and publishing them. And I have that currently available on my website for pre-sale. I intend to release that in 2023. So you can check that out. And I have these books also listed on my website. So if you want to do more reading, henrywilsonhistory.com is a great place to start.
Fantastic. And of course, if people want to learn more than that, they can also check out your podcast. So how can people learn more about you? How can they learn about the podcast? How can they access everything that you do, your website?
Yeah, so the podcast will be about 21 to 22 episodes. It's about 30 minutes per episode on average. And then there's a bunch of bonus episodes that include my interviews with authors and historians and some of the other little tidbits that I just couldn't fit into an episode relating to, you know, the road to the Civil War, Reconstruction, stuff like that. And so you can find out all about the podcast at henrywilsonhistory.com. The podcast is available just about on every podcast platform. So whatever you're listening to Untold Civil War on, you should be able to find Henry Wilson and the Civil War on that platform as well. But if you can't, head to henrywilsonhistory.com and you can right on the homepage, I have all of the links listed to find how to listen.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing the story with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I've had fun.
Thank you for listening while you did the dishes, vacuumed the living room, advancing with Sherman, or not advancing with McClellan, or whenever you listen to podcasts. Have you got a Civil War business? Maybe you're planning a Civil War event. Need a logo, shirt, or even sticker design? Look no further than 1863 Designs. Make your business or event truly stand out with the help of real experts who not only know graphic design, but love Civil War history. Link in the show notes. And don't forget to check out our website and click on the Untold Civil War Curiosities tab. We've got all sorts of merch and original Civil War items for sale, proceeds of which go directly to supporting the show. We may have some World War I and World War II items that may have snuck in there, so don't miss out. Well, bye for now, and I hope you tune in next time for our next episode.